Lecture 29, Confessionalization in Germany.
Having looked at France, the Low Countries, and England in the late 16th century, we return in this lecture to Germany, and the story where we left it at the end of Lecture 19, namely with the Peace of Augsburg in 1555 as the compromise for disagreement and conflict between Catholics and Lutherans in the Holy Roman Empire. The overarching theme of today's lecture is how, on the one hand, the Peace of Augsburg indeed provided a framework for the relatively stable coexistence between Catholics and Protestants within the Holy Roman Empire. But on the other hand, that same framework also allowed for the emergence and the buildup of tensions and problems both across the different religious traditions as well as within them during the later decades of the 16th century, and that these tensions and difficulties would emerge and bubble up beneath the surface of the process of confessionalization that was at work. In looking at Lutheranism, Calvinism, and Roman Catholicism in Germany, we'll be considering then not only the tensions between them, but also within each of the three traditions. First, though, we need to understand, have some idea of what's meant by that long and unwieldy word, confessionalization. Confessionalization means, essentially, the creation of distinct confessional identities by the combined efforts of churches and states. That is, we're talking about the long-term process by which distinct but parallel Christian traditions and identities were created and strengthened through the actions of secular and ecclesiastical authorities working more or less in tandem through institutions across the population as a whole. A symbiotic relationship, in other words, is what confessionalization is about between churches, whether Lutheran, Calvinist, or Catholic, and territorial states in the Holy Roman Empire, each with something to gain from the other. Princes recognize that self-conscious Christians generally make obedient subjects, while priests and ministers recognize that secular institutions can provide a stable framework for inculcating Christian doctrines and morals. The scope of the process across the population as a whole is important. It includes and involves not simply those who made the reformations, the reformers themselves, and those deeply committed to one or another view of true Christianity, but also to those who are less enthusiastic, whatever their social standing. Most of these, as we know and have seen throughout the course, are common people, rural villagers, and people who are not zealous Christians in urban environments. Remember, too, in every instance where we talk about Germany, about the Holy Roman Empire, its political patchwork nature. Just as this allowed the Reformation to take hold in the 1520s and 30s, so too, under the terms of the Peace of Augsburg, it allows for the spread and for attempts to solidify a ruler's particular form of Christianity. There's a real contrast here with England and France, where monarchies led to state-mandated orthodoxies and internal religious minorities, whether the case of Catholics in England or of the Huguenots in France. The political patchwork of Central Europe is different. It's important, finally, in these introductory remarks about confessionalization, to emphasize that this is a long-term process. It's one that's not completed in the 16th or even the 17th century, but lasts indeed into the 18th. It's also a parallel process to be observed across the distinctions between Lutherans, Catholics, and Calvinists in Germany. Moreover, the same broad phenomenon is at work in other countries that are dominated by a single tradition, for example, English Protestantism or French Catholicism. We're basically talking then here about the long-term formation of the sensibilities and the behavior of modern Christians, the movement from official legislation to the internalization of religious attitudes, beliefs, and practices. We'll look then, in turn, in this lecture, first at Lutheranism, then at Calvinism, and finally at Catholicism in Germany, in the decades after the Peace of Augsburg. While keeping this parallel development in mind that I've just mentioned, I also want to draw your attention to the differences and the tensions between these traditions, Catholics, Lutherans, Calvinists, as well as to the frictions within each of them. I know this is a somewhat complicated scheme, but all three elements are essential for trying to understand what's going on in these decades, namely the parallels across the three, the friction between the three, and the tensions or problems within each of them. Let's begin then with German Lutheranism after the Peace of Augsburg. Now, there are real reasons to regard the Peace of Augsburg as a triumph for Lutheranism in Germany. Essentially, again, we're talking about the legal and political legitimation of the challenge to Roman Catholicism, a de facto recognition by the Holy Roman Emperor of Lutheran strength and of the impossibility of eradicating Lutheranism in Germany by the 1550s. The Peace of Augsburg also ushers in a period of relatively calm coexistence between Catholics and Lutherans after the Peace of Augsburg, at least when judged by the standard of the tensions and the wars of the 1540s and the early 1550s. There are numerous examples in the later 16th century of cities in which Catholics and Lutherans coexist relatively peacefully. In the 1560s and 70s, Augsburg is one such city. Ulm would be another with its extraordinary church tower. Ravensburg is a third, and we could give other examples. Again, this stands in sharp contrast to the lectures we've just had on the wars of religion in France or on the Dutch revolt in the Low Countries. Even in Munster, the once again Catholic city comes to tolerate small Lutheran and small peaceful Anabaptist minorities. There are also numerous examples during the later 16th century in the Holy Roman Empire of Lutherans and Catholics intermarrying, one of the surest signs that a degree of coexistence has been reached. So again, all these are examples of fundamentally successful coexistence of Catholics and Lutherans in the Holy Roman Empire after the Peace of Augsburg. At the same time, however, other aspects of Lutheranism in the later 16th century complicate this picture of a triumph after the Peace of Augsburg. I'll mention two of the most significant difficulties. One is a theological dispute within Lutheranism that broke it into two competing groups. The other is related to the process of confessionalization that we talked about earlier. First of all, the theological disagreement, then. For this, we need to recall the reimposition of Catholicism by Charles V after his victory over the Schmalkaldic League in 1547, the Augsburg Interim. Charles V reimposes Catholicism, or attempts to, on Lutheran German territories. This engenders disagreement on the part of those Lutheran towns and territories about how to respond, to resist, or to accommodate and compromise. This issue divides Lutheran leadership and accompanying Lutheran men and women into two camps, one more hard line and the other more moderate. The hardliners are self-described genuine Lutherans, Nasio Lutherans they call themselves. They're led by a group of Lutheran theologians and ministers centered in the town of Magdeburg. They insist on completely rejecting the stipulations of the interim, the reimposition of Catholicism. The moderates are known as Philippists. They take their name from their leader, Philip Melanchthon, Luther's right-hand man in Wittenberg. Melanchthon himself dies in 1560. The Philippists thought that less was essential to Lutheran orthodoxy than did the Nasio, or genuine Lutherans. Hence, they have a greater willingness to accept more aspects of Charles V's interim. The death of Martin Luther in 1546 means that there is no longer a central figure within German Lutheranism to moderate disagreements like this. This difference, to be sure, was already simmering before it came into the open in 1548. It was related to other differences as well, differences about the interpretation of the Lord's Supper, about how exactly the Augsburg Confession of 1530 was to be regarded, and so forth. Generally speaking, we're talking here about the difference between a more versus a less rigorous religious mentality. Now, where have we seen something analogous to this before. We just saw it in the previous lecture in the difference between conformist Protestants and Puritans in England. We saw something analogous as well in Lecture 22 when we talked about Dutch Mennonites and their questions about discipline, the Waterlanders versus the Mennonites in dealing with the ban and shunning. It's important, I think, to recognize certain family resemblances like these among the various traditions that we've been studying, because they reveal common underlying concerns about religious identity and its relationship both to religious beliefs and practices across Protestantism, radical Protestantism, and Catholicism. In 1577, a new agreement was reached between the two groups, the Philippists and the Nazio-Lutherans. This agreement is known as the Formula of Concord. The Formula of Concord. It's published in 1580, at the 50th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession. About two-thirds of the Lutheran territories subscribe to it, and it eases the tension between the two factions, although it excluded those who were strongly committed to one view or the other. Nonetheless, it provides the basis in subsequent decades for Lutheran orthodoxy in Germany. This dispute between hardliners and moderates shows important disagreements within Lutheranism under the terms of the Peace of Augsburg. The harsh condemnations of each side by the other shouldn't surprise us. We saw something similar among Dutch Mennonites. So even though they're both German Lutherans, sometimes that brings out greater bitterness than one would anticipate. The second tension or problem, difficulty, within Lutheranism that should lead us to at least qualify the extent to which we think the Peace of Augsburg was a harbinger of its success, involved the difficulties of inculcating Lutheran beliefs and behaviors among ordinary Christians. Lutheranism had become the official religion of most of the territories of Germany. It was protected by secular authorities, both cities and increasingly territorial princes. But did Lutheran pastors succeed in making ordinary people into Christians knowledgeable about their faith? How well did ordinary men and women internalize the basics of Lutheran teachings and live them out? For the minority living in towns and cities, it seems that a fairly significant inculcation of Lutheran views and behaviors indeed took place. Cities, as you'll recall, are always characterized by higher literacy. They have a greater density of pastors. There are more schools and churches than there are in rural areas. For the majority living in the countryside, however, a different picture emerges. On the basis of detailed records from visitations conducted by local secular officials working together with local church authorities, we can draw an analogy here, too, to the pastoral visitations mandated by the Council of Trent of post-Tridentine bishops. But on the basis of these visitation records conducted in the late 16th and the early 17th century, we find three important things. The first, a great deal of evidence for widespread ignorance of even the most basic aspects of Lutheran teaching. People that don't know the Ten Commandments, people that don't know the Lord's Prayer, the doctrinal basics of justification by faith alone, etc. We find considerable apathy about religion in general, absenteeism from Sunday services, ignoring sermons, refusing to sing in church, etc. There are glaring behavioral vices and shortcomings, fighting, heavy drinking, gambling, wife beating. Despite, that is, all these behavioral problems and apathy and so forth, despite continued and repeated catechetical and sermon instruction over decades about all these things. This is not just in 1550s, we're talking 1570s, 1590s, and into the 17th century. The second thing that we find in the visitation records is a strong strain of Protestant anti-clericalism. That is, resentment against the Lutheran pastors, in some cases as being even more intrusive and obnoxious than their less earnest, more easygoing Catholic predecessors had been. We find terms like a new popery. These priests are even worse than the old ones. There are complaints about how long and difficult to follow their sermons are, about how terrible it is being nagged Sunday after Sunday about all their behavioral shortcomings. These are the sorts of things that ordinary Christians say repeatedly to the visitation committees. Finally, the third thing that we find, widespread evidence for the persistence of many traditional Catholic sensibilities. For example, women call regularly on the patron saints of childbirth, Saints Anne and Margaret, even though there was supposed to have been no invocation of the saints in Lutheran areas. So when the pain gets terrible, you go to what you trust, I guess. We find evidence for treating certain material objects as though they were relics or had supernatural powers. In a supreme irony, images of Luther himself come to be treated as though he were a kind of saint. Extraordinarily interesting research has been done on this. Now, why was it that Lutheran pastors weren't able to instill Lutheran Christianity in the majority of the population easily? Again, we're talking about decades. It's not as if they couldn't do it within a year. We're talking about 50 or 60 years. At least two reasons come to mind, one from the side of the clergy and the other from the side of the laity. On the clerical side, the Lutheran pastor's catechetical pedagogy, the emphasis on rote memorization, on extreme repetition, and especially a stress on the written and spoken language as the exclusive means for articulating and teaching religion, was in the end largely ineffective with people who were still so heavily visual and oral in their communicative orientation. There's a real contrast here, I think, not only with Catholic techniques using plays, prints, pictures, whatever, to get the point across, but also with those visual woodcuts of the early evangelical movement. This emphasis on the verbal, the spoken, the written, to the exclusion of other means was even stronger in the Reformed Protestant tradition, in Calvinism, with its stronger aversion to images and idolatry. From the side of the laity, one scholar has referred to a breakdown of the coalition between the clergy and magistrates and laity that allowed the early evangelical movement to succeed in its early years. We might indeed be able to push this all the way back to the defeat of the peasants in 1525. It seems to me that this lays the foundation, at least to some degree, for the tepid response to Lutheranism in the later 16th century. That is, the realization that Luther's priesthood of all believers doesn't mean the end of social hierarchy. It doesn't mean the end or radical transformation of political institutions. It doesn't mean any huge transformation even in the authority of the clergy in the lives of ordinary men and women. Lutheran pastors then appear as the new priests, and we have that anti-clericalism that I mentioned a moment ago. In part, a dissatisfaction with Lutheranism results in a dissatisfaction with the way in which Lutheranism can achieve disciplinary or behavioral goals leads to some princes in Germany adopting Calvinism in the later 16th century in what is sometimes called Germany's Second Reformation. We're talking here about a phenomenon that arises around 1560 and continues in the subsequent decades. After this time, then, there are three major Christian groups in Germany: Lutherans, Catholics, and now Calvinists, with their distinct churches, worship, and teachings, in addition, of course, to the relatively small numbers of Anabaptists and other radicals. This Second Reformation, the emergence of Calvinism in Germany, stands in sharp contrast to the protest movement of the 1520s, in that it is not the result of an upsurge of popular support for Calvinism. Rather, it is very decidedly Reformation from above. In each case, it's a prince who previously was Lutheran converting to Calvinism, who attempts to make his territory then fall into line with Calvinist worship and doctrine. The first prince to do this is Frederick III of the Palatinate. The Palatinate is a territory in south-central Germany. Frederick was himself an intensely devout man who converted based on his own reading and study of scripture and theology in 1561. Between the 1560s and the 1590s, over a dozen other German Lutheran princes would follow him in converting to Calvinism. The Palatinate remained the most important German Calvinist territory throughout the remainder of the 16th century and into the 17th. Its university, Heidelberg, became a center of Reformed Protestant learning, the most important in Germany, and one of the most important in all of Europe. The Palatinate also established a series of ecclesiastical ordinances in 1563 that became a model for other German territories that adopted Calvinism in turn. Part of these 1563 ordinances was the Heidelberg Catechism, which becomes analogously influential as a Reformed Protestant catechism. So the Palatinate becomes a center for Calvinism in Germany, and it establishes these important measures. And so after 1560, just a few years after the Peace of Augsburg, there are three major groups in place of two in the Holy Roman Empire. Technically, this was illegal. You'll recall that the Peace of Augsburg specified that rulers could adopt either the Lutheranism of the Augsburg Confession or Roman Catholicism. Now, Frederick III and the other German Calvinist princes claimed that what they were doing was instituting a form of Protestantism in accord with the Peace of Augsburg. The adoption of Calvinism was challenged and resented by Lutheran princes, at whose expense, of course, it was gaining in Germany. It's Lutheran princes who convert to Calvinism. When push came to shove, however, they tolerated it, in part because they could not afford to let the tensions between themselves, that is, Lutheran princes and Calvinist princes, trump their concern for Catholicism in Germany. So it creates new dynamics among the various traditions. Tensions were exacerbated as a result, and they influenced the division between the hard line and the moderate Lutherans. The latter, for example, the moderate Philippists, were accused of being secret Calvinists because of their more lenient view on the Lord's Supper, because of Melanchthon's friendship with Calvin, and so forth. The Lutheran formula of concord, which I mentioned a few moments ago, from 1577, is accordingly a strongly anti-Calvinist document. So tensions between Lutherans and Calvinists in Germany. Finally, a last note about Calvinism on the international level. The emergence of Calvinism in Germany spurs concerns for and about the communications with Calvinists in Germany and those among the Huguenots in France, the Dutch Calvinists fighting against Spain. It's feared in Germany that German Calvinism is going to drag Central Europe into the French and the Dutch conflicts, yet another arena of tension. Moving now to Catholicism. German Catholicism reached a low point around 1550. Even in towns and territories that had not become Lutheran, the numbers of priests being ordained had plummeted. Many parishes were without any clergy at all. In addition, both in the number of territories and in the geographical area covered, the majority of Germany had gone with the Reformation. When the Jesuit Peter Canisius traveled through Germany in 1550 and 1551, he complained about the deplorable state of the clergy and the ignorance of the laity. On the other hand, because Lutheran efforts at indoctrination and catechetical training had fallen short, as we just discussed, because many people were still attached somewhat to traditional practices and beliefs closer to Catholicism, there was a real opportunity for a new Catholicization, especially when we couple this with post-Tridentine efforts to reach the laity through a wider range of means and in a more simplified way than the rote memorization and catechetical methods of the Lutheran and Calvinist pastors. Beginning then in the 1550s and accelerating after the 1580s, Catholicism made a significant recovery in Germany, including many territories that had at one point or another adopted the Reformation. There were three key factors in this process of Catholic recovery. And here some of the points overlap with the discussion of the implementation of the decrees after the Council of Trent. The three factors were the German college and its alumni, the Jesuits, and the model of Bavaria as a German Catholic territory. First, the German college was founded in Rome in 1552 to train parish priests to serve in German territories as those new model post-Tridentine priests, educated, austere, conscientious. They were to help remedy both the shortage of priests that I just mentioned, as well as their mediocre talents and level of concern. The German college was run and operated by the Jesuits in Rome, who were responsible for training the new priests. It begins turning out a few in the 1550s, and significant numbers start coming in the 1570s. Secondly, the Jesuits themselves established a number of colleges for educating German Catholic boys and young men, beginning with the first one in Cologne in 1544, and increasing in subsequent decades in many towns in the Holy Roman Empire, including Vienna, Worms, Augsburg, and Ingolstadt. By the 1630s, there were over 3,000 Jesuits in Germany and Austria, helping to run 65 different colleges. They do the Jesuit thing. They emphasize what needs to be done, in this case, education, missionary work among Protestants, and writings against Lutherans and Calvinists. The Jesuits blamed the other religious orders and parish priests for blowing it, essentially, for allowing the Reformation to happen in the first place. They deplored the laxness, the lack of vigilance among the other priests that they were coming to supplant. They see themselves, to a large extent, as the saviors of the Roman Church. As a result, as we can understand, there was frequently tension between them and the members of other Catholic religious orders in the Holy Roman Empire. So the German college established, the Jesuits, the third factor was the territory of Bavaria itself, which in the second half of the 16th century becomes the model for other German Catholic states, the model for a vigorous, diligent, confessional Catholic state. Essentially, what the Palatinate was to German Calvinism, Bavaria becomes for German Catholicism. This takes place under a series of Bavarian dukes committed to promoting a revitalized Catholicism in their lands. For example, the dukes themselves are the personal patrons promoting pilgrimages in Bavaria. At the same time, and again, remember my point about the tensions within these various traditions, the influx of the Jesuits, as well as the efforts by certain bishops in the Tridentine mold, led to resentment by clergy who were already in place, who didn't want to change, didn't want the reorganization of ecclesiastical arrangements to their disadvantage. Nonetheless, by the 1580s, by the 1590s, Catholicism in general, and the new model Catholicism of the sort prescribed by Trent, was making significant inroads in Central Europe, a process that would continue into the early 17th century. It was a process not unnoticed by Protestant princes, who viewed it with real concern. We see, then, that the Peace of Augsburg provided a framework for relative stability after 1555, but that tension grew within this framework, not only among three different established church orders by now, Lutheranism, Catholicism, and Calvinism, but also within them, in the resistance to catechetical efforts by Lutheran pastors, in the intransigence of German priests to activities by the Jesuits and reform-minded bishops, in the international complications feared from the growth of Calvinism in Germany. All of these and more would feed into the devastation of the 30 Years' War in the first half of the 17th century. In closing today, I want to mention three important points about the significance of confessionalization, which you're now in a position to appreciate. First, as far as the relationship between ecclesiastical and secular authorities is concerned, confessionalization underlines and reinforces the dependence of ecclesiastical on secular authorities. It's a process that we've seen in the domestication of the early evangelical movement in the 1520s, as well as in the post-Tridentine popes' dealings with rulers like Philip II. There is no question that in terms of political power and control, priests and pastors, whether Catholic or Protestant, can do their thing only if a given ruler permits them to. All we have to do to make this point crystal clear is to compare Jesuits in Bavaria advising their dukes on political policy in the 1580s to Jesuits in England risking their lives as missionaries in Elizabethan England. Secondly, as far as the relationship among Christian traditions is concerned, despite the difficulties of inculcating beliefs and behaviors, confessionalization institutionalizes and hardens the divisions among Lutheranism, Catholicism, and Calvinism. The initial years of the Reformation are now two or three generations in the past. distinct doctrines, ways of worshiping, have emerged and been institutionalized. Emblematic and symptomatic of this are the Catholic Tridentine Catechism, the Calvinist Heidelberg Catechism, the Lutheran Formula of Concord. Indeed, ironically, scholasticism is used by all three traditions now as a way of systematizing and arranging doctrinal statements now regarded as authoritative and the guide for competing orthodoxies. And the third point to be made about confessionalization. We shouldn't lose sight of the incompleteness and the local variations in this process. Despite the forces of bureaucratization and state building, despite those dramatic displays of power that hold our attention, the executions by early modern states of dissidents, for example, we should not by any means exaggerate either the centralized character of the confessionalization process. It was heavily variable depending on region. We shouldn't exaggerate the ease or the rapidity with which it occurred. There was a lot of resistance. It took well over a century to really take hold. Nor should we exaggerate its thoroughness. No early modern state had anything remotely like the reach, the communications, the bureaucracy, the efficiency of power that states in the 20th and now the 21st century exhibit. All right, then. In our next three lectures, we'll leave the late 16th century and move into the early 17th, continuing our look at these various national contexts and the relationship of Christian groups to one another in them.